afternoon, I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order for Monday, February 9th, 2009. Committee, we have three bills on our public hearing list, and we're going to start out with House Bill 2354, and then we're going to go into an informational portion that I'm going to have in front of House Bill 2191 and 2368. So, and we also have an introduction of a LC that should be in front of you. So I think maybe we'll just take care of that first. So I'd like to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures. And as soon as we find the LC, I probably took it from him. Oh, there it is. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we committee introduce LC 2517 as a legislative concept.
Representative Riley moves LC 2517 to be introduced as a committee bill. The discussion is this doesn't obligate you to support or oppose the bill. It's just simply to allow us to have this bill drafted for future consideration by this body. Discussions? And just a moment. Are there any objections to adopting this LC as a committee bill? Seeing none, it's so adopted. With that, I'll close the work session and open a public hearing on House Bill 2354. And first up, I'd like to have Bobby Weinstock. Good afternoon. Welcome to our committee, and if you would introduce yourself for the record before you start.
Yes. Thank you for having me. My name is Bobby Weinstock, and I live in Portland. And thanks for this opportunity, Chair, committee members. I want to speak from the perspective of someone who has actually been impacted by a condo conversion personally. And also from, I work at a social service agency, so I work with lots of seniors who have also been impacted by condo conversions in Portland. Just before Christmas of 2006, I and my 30 neighbors all got eviction notices from the new owner of our apartment building in Northwest Portland, and we were told to get out by February. And that was about the extent of the notice that we got. It created all kinds of emotional distress over the holidays. And it also cost me $1,800 to move to another place. That included the moving fee and the application fees and the deposits and the first and last at the new place. It was a three-story walk-up, so it was kind of an expensive move because they had to carry everything with no elevator down the three flights of steps. Same situation with my 30 neighbors, many of whom were in worse shape than I was, artists and musicians and students. Experienced the same kind of issue with the seniors that I work with at Northwest Pilot Project. We're a small nonprofit in downtown Portland, and many of the apartment buildings where seniors were living turned over new ownership, and then notices that folks had to move out, and then conversion into condominiums. And the seniors come to our office kind of desperate, not knowing where to find comparable housing, and also not knowing how they're going to pay for the costs involved in relocation. And that was a big problem that we were seeing in our agency. So I want to urge your support of this bill. We understand that the property owner and the new owner has the right to do what they want with their property. But what we're seeing is that the private business decision is leading to all this emotional and financial hardship for folks who are having a really hard time bearing it. So we would just ask that that the owner mitigate the financial hardship that they're causing by kicking people out and converting to condos. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Before we go into any questions, failed to have Victoria give us a brief description of the bill, so it may be helpful for you to do that at this time now that we've heard the testimony.
House Bill 2354 requires a declarant of a condominium conversion to provide to tenant either a relocation payment equal to 3 times the Section 8 fair market rent or to reduce the purchase price of the unit by the same amount.
Thank you. To put your testimony in context, questions, Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this was Section 8 housing that you were in, is that true?
No, it was just a regular private market apartment building.
Follow-up? May I have a series of questions, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Thank you. So did you have a lease agreement?
I lived there for 8 years, but it was a month-to-month. Many people lived there for 20 years, but it was month-to-month.
Follow-up,
please.
So was it a long-time owner who had it and then sold it to
That's exactly
a new owner?
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions? So Bobby, how do you arrive at the amount? I mean, 3 times the rent. I mean, can you explain to us why you think that would be fair as opposed to 2 times or some other figure?
I mean, it's going to vary based on the type of apartment that a person's in and the size of the apartment, but the 3 times work pretty much in my situation. We were paying $650 a month, and it cost us $1,800 to move about 3 times. And by the time you hire a mover and pay application fees, security deposits at your new place, first and last month's rent, I'm guessing 3 times the amount of your rent is, you know, a fair estimate of what the relocation costs are going to be. That's about what we're seeing with our senior clients also at the social service agency I work with.
So why when somebody's doing a condo conversion, do you think they shouldn't have to make this payment as opposed to a landlord just saying, I'm giving you 30 days notice, I want you to move out because, you know, I want to move into it myself or some other reason? I mean, I think they have landlord has the ability to give you 30 days notice on a month-to-month rent to get you to move. So why does a condo conversion, do you feel, need special treatment?
One, because at least at that point in time, there were a whole lot of them. And lots of very vulnerable and low-income people were being displaced by kind of the condo craze that was happening at least in Portland and I'm sure in some other areas around the state. So just from the sheer volume of folks who were being evicted from their apartments, many of whom were low-income, and were having a really hard time figuring out what to do. It's kind of balancing out the owner's right and pursuit of private profit with the owner's social obligation to mitigate some of the harm that's being caused to people who were least able to bear that harm.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So about the cost, again, the three times, you based that on your experience, and I gathered you to say that that covered moving expenses and first and last and application fees. Is that right?
That's right.
When you moved out of your apartment, you didn't have to pay another month's rent there, so you would have paid that month's rent anyway.
Right.
And did you have a last on your old apartment?
I didn't.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other? Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some significant concerns with the bill. Not least because it seems to me this hard and fast rule, especially the three times, it seems both over and under inclusive, in that it's over inclusive in that it would compensate some whom I just don't know if it's a justified market interference. For example, a high-end apartment building, the Wyatt in Portland, for example, if, were that ever to be, it's not foreseeable it would be converted to condos. That would be probably such a prohibitive amount that it would potentially just stifle that as an option altogether, conversion at the high-end market. On the other hand, in the low-end market, perhaps it actually doesn't go far enough to compensate certain people who might genuinely need it, who are actually members of Section 8, for example. But as it stands now, it seems kind of an awkward fix, and I find it problematic.
Representative Cowan.
Did he want to respond?
Oh, do you want to respond to that?
I was just going to say, as a group, renters tend to be, of course, lower income as a group than homeowners. But if there's a way to target more precisely the income level of the renters that you want to protect, I wouldn't see a big problem with that. Most of the renters, though, are, I would say, more on the lower income level than the renters at the Wyatt. That would be the exception, I would say, in the renter pool.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I wasn't part of this committee in 07, so I was only peripherally involved with the discussion around manufactured home parks and reaching some kind of an agreement. But what I do know is that there was a lot of work of a kind of a combined task force advisory group effort to sort of hammer out some kind of a proposal that might work for when a similar displacement comes about as someone trying to buy out a manufactured home park. So I guess I'm wondering if there's been any attempt to kind of bring interested parties together and put forth kind of a joint proposal. I see that this bill was filed at the request of the House Interim Committee on Judiciary, so I'm just sort of trying to get a feel for the effort that's gone into bringing owners and renters and together and working on a proposal. Could you enlighten me a little bit?
I don't know the specific history of this bill or of any joint meetings between the mobile home advocates and the renter advocates. The only work I was aware of that had to do with condo conversions before was getting adequate notice to folks who were being displaced so that they would have 4 months to figure out what they were going to do instead of 1 month.
Okay.
And that bill passed in the last legislative session.
Follow up.
And
remind me again, how much notice did you have when this happened to your...
We got notice just before Christmas of 06, and we had to be out February of 07.
So about a little over two months. Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Representative Widener?
Actually, Representative Cowan got mine. I was wondering how much notice you had, but sorry you had to go through this, sir, and thank you for coming here today and testifying to us so we can understand the issues that are going on out there.
Thank you.
Don't see any other questions today, Mr. Weinstock. Thank you very much for coming forward to testify in favor of this bill.
Thank you.
It is definitely an issue for a lot of people, I know that, so I appreciate it. Next up, I'd like to have Jonathan Clay. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Jonathan Clay, and I'm speaking here today representing Metro Multifamily Housing Association in opposition of Housing Bill 2354. We're an educational and professional development and trade organization for landlords. We have annual events, instructional classes, up-to-date brittle forms. We really create a professional community that proudly promotes quality brittle housing throughout Oregon, representing landlords from one investment house to a portfolio of thousands of rental units. As I said, we're here in opposition of Housing Bill 2354 today for a variety of reasons. First, the tenants of a property slated for condominium conversion already have strong safeguards to ensure fairness during a conversion, while owners are also treated fairly. And a lot of that came to light last session in 2007. And under Oregon law, the landlords already have significant good faith obligations, as I was saying, when they're planning to convert rental property to condominiums. There's a notice that must be given to the tenant at least 120 days prior to the conversion. Then it's not an eviction notice. It simply, you know, informs them of the conversion plan. The landlord is restricted from issuing no-cause termination notices, and they're limited around raising the rent during or before that 120-day conversion notice period. The statute also allows a local city or county to adopt an ordinance that requires property owners converting to condos to pay the expenses of a tenant vacating the conversion unit. I know that in Portland, they've already taken advantage of that. I know it's restricted to lower-income households. Tenants are given first opportunity to purchase the unit they reside in at least 60 days to reject that offer. As with any other tenancy, the condo chapter dictates that a landlord must secure tenant permission to show the conversion unit to a prospective buyer. Even the construction hours are limited in conversion buildings between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. And of course, no work could be done within a tenant's unit during that 120-day notice period. But unfortunately, the House bill that we're talking about, 2354, tips that scale of fairness. We believe Section 2 of that bill requires any property owner planning to convert his or her building to condominiums to pay three times the Section 8 fair market rent, which is adjusted for unit type by the Secretary of HUD within 30 days of providing the 120-day notice. Consider this scenario. You know, a typical brick construction finished apartment building in North Portland, for example, might consist of 60 units that rent for approximately $650 a month. The converted units might each sell in the future for around $160,000. House Bill 2354 requires the owners to pay a cash payment to the tenants of $117,000 within 30 days of providing the 120-day condo conversion notice. They also, of course, the tenants have the option to take that sum of three times the fair market rent and apply it towards the purchase. But if not, that's an upfront expense that, you know, few owners can manage. And we fear the result of that would be fewer affordable homes for purchase. The reality of today's economic downturn is that condo conversions have dramatically reduced. you know, the Oregonian reported last fall that Portland has a 5-year supply of available units, and that figure would be even higher if developers hadn't converted about 1,400 condo units to rental apartments in 2008. So despite the glut in new construction condominiums available, this bill has the unintended consequence of decreasing the availability of affordable homes, specifically vintage refurbished units, by limiting the most affordable segment of housing available. 2354 would move the potential for home ownership further from those who currently rent or are saving for the day they can own their own residence, for example. I very much thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Questions? Representative Widener.
Just a quick one here. To me, that kind of bugs me a little bit when you spell this out. You're putting $160,000 for house bills, what each unit would sell, and then you add the point and the zero zeros afterwards. It almost seems like you're trying to make things look worse than what they are when we're reading this.
Oh, dear. That's not
and,
my intention.
Yeah, it's just one of those things that makes it look like you're doing something shady, even with us trying to pull funny math. But I mean, I think everything...
Thank you for that.
Looking at everything here, it looks like the laws are in pretty good order to protect both sides, just from what I'm seeing. But in future reference, when you're writing stuff up, this isn't something that impresses me when I'm looking at it. So,
well, point taken. Thank you very much, Representative Wiener.
Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clay, you heard previous testimony from Mr. Weinstock, and I believe he had said that his notice was received December of 2006 and moved out February of 2007. Is that correct?
That's what I heard as well.
And so these new safeguards would not have been in place in his situation. They were as of the session of 2007. Is that correct?
Right. It was only just last session that that the 120-day notice was mandated.
So we could assume that if it would have been, let's say, a year forward, and it would have been December of 07, his situation would have been dealt with much differently into the letter of this law that you've spelled out in your testimony, correct?
Dramatically different. He wouldn't have a move-out date until the end of March or beginning of April.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, but even under the current law, though, there's no reimbursement to the renter to help them go down the road and look for a new place under the current law that we just passed either, is there?
That's correct. There's not. I believe that there was that this language was similar to the original bill in 2007.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Appreciate you taking the time to come here again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
And testify
thank you so much.
On this bill. I really appreciate it. So I don't see anyone else signed up to testify on House Bill 2354 at this point, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2354. And committee, next up we have a couple of bills, House Bill 2191 and House Bill 2368, both dealing with the worlds of debt management and debt settlement. But before we open a public hearing on that, I took it upon myself to ask some folks from DCBS and some industry folks to come and give us an overview of this industry. I think would be helpful. And so with that, I'd like to call up DCBS, Department of Consumer Business Services, David Tapman. I have you on my list. And of course, if you want somebody to come help you, you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, this is David Tapman with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I've asked to have some testimony handed out for you. It's written testimony that basically was prepared in conjunction with 2191, which will lay out both overview of the industry and also some of the specific concerns that we have. And rather than go through this twice, I thought maybe I could just do it all at once now. I'll defer to the chair depending on how he wants to proceed.
Along with the informational piece, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing on House Bill 2191 and open a hearing on House Bill 2368, so you can talk about anything you want.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. The matter we have in front of you today is two separate bills plus this overview that addresses an area that you probably haven't heard a lot about up until the last year or so. But with the change in the economy, we have seen significant interest and increase in the use of these various companies that provide services to consumers who find themselves falling behind in their ability to cover debt. And there are a very wide variety of names involved. We are trying to use the word debt management to simply act as an umbrella to pick up all these different terms. The different terms involve debt consolidation agencies, credit service organizations, and a new phrase that we use, debt settlement companies. And they have separate meanings, and I'll try and walk through that. I know that the committee has a number of witnesses prepared to testify today with greater expertise in each one of those areas, so I will just give you a brief thumbnail on each one of those companies or concepts and then let your other witnesses get to that. The reason why we came forward with our bill, 2191, was to propose an expansion of our oversight of debt management services. Historically, we've been charged with the oversight of debt consolidation agencies and credit service organizations, but as I said, we have seen recently a proliferation of companies that provide debt settlement services. And relatively new, but very aggressive. You've probably heard them on the radio. You've heard them on television if you stay up late. You find them on the internet. In fact, just this weekend, I was going through the internet kind of trolling, just put in the word debt settlement, and I couldn't keep track of all the pages of advertisements that were available. I understand that you have another witness that will testify and provide you actual hard copy or photocopies of some of these internet ads. So I'll let you see those firsthand from that witness. But I think you've probably heard the ones that advertise, we can reduce the debt by 50 or 60 or even 75%, and we can get your debt settled in 12 to 30 months. Some pretty miraculous claims if you think about the circumstances that some of the people find themselves in this day and age. We have also received, as an agency, a number of complaints about these debt settlement companies. As I say, we don't currently regulate them because they don't fall within the purview of what we do regulate, and that's one of the things we will be asking this committee is to authorize the oversight of debt settlement companies. Number of complaints have come forward about people who have used these services. Typically, these services say that if you will pay an upfront fee, usually it's a substantial fee, it can be anywhere from 15% to 25% to 30%, and we've heard even higher, of the amount of debt to be settled. And some companies will do it differently. They'll take a percentage of whatever they save you. But nonetheless, this is money that you have to pay up front. And so that's obviously a challenge for a number of consumers to begin with. Many of these debt settlement companies will then say, do not contact your creditor, which in my perspective is a terrible piece of advice because the creditors don't know what's going on. And that's the worst thing you want to do when the creditors come knocking and are trying to figure out where a debtor is on a particular debt. They are told in many instances, you save your money up, we will negotiate a settlement for you. You hold on to that money until we negotiate that settlement, and then we'll instruct you when to make the payment. And in return, we'll be able to make this payment as either a lump sum or occasionally it's paid out over a period of time, but that payment will reflect a significant reduction in principal as well as interest owed. In most instances, we've had our complaints say that they've paid this money up front, but in fact never received any services, or if any services were obtained from these companies, it was a very nominal amount of money that was actually paid towards the debt, and a significantly higher or greater amount of money that was paid in fees to the debt settlement company. In addition, by delaying the process, by having people put their money in their own bank account and hold that money until such time as there's a settlement, the individual debtors are not in contact with their creditors, and the creditors are proceeding to do what creditors are going to do, and that's take steps to collect the debt. In many instances, because there's no contact and they haven't heard from the consumer or the debtor, they will proceed to file the lawsuit to make a collection, and then they will obtain a judgment, which will result potentially in garnishment of wages or garnishment of bank accounts. Ultimately, therefore, by waiting and going down this road, the consumer is much more greatly harmed. Furthermore, we hear circumstances where consumers will pursue these services when, in fact, it may not be the best remedy for them, assuming they get what's actually being represented to them. That is, they are so far into debt that there is no meaningful way that they can repay a significant amount of money under their current circumstances to satisfy the creditor. What they would be better, it would behoove them or would be better counsel is to go through either bankruptcy or some other form of addressing the problem. But because many of the people in the debt settlement industry are getting paid based on commissions and receiving payment because they bring in a certain number of consumers, there's no incentive for them to steer people in other directions. Now, what I've included in my packet of testimony is a two-page document that we took off the Internet from MSN. MSNBC, I believe, is where we found it. And it's just a summary of some of the basics about debt settlement. And I'll just refer that to you, and you can read that at your own leisure. I think it's useful to kind of give you a primer. But as I say, you'll have other witnesses, I'm sure, that want to talk about that. In addition, we've seen changes in the bankruptcy law. Significant changes took place in 2006. And those changes mandated that people that were filing for personal bankruptcy, what you and I think of typically as Chapter 7 bankruptcy, have to go through counseling before they can file for bankruptcy. Now, I think conceptually that's a great idea, but sometimes that counseling can slow the process down. Our bankruptcy courts in Oregon, the U.S. Trustee's Office that oversees much of this activity, requires everyone to be licensed that provide the bankruptcy education component. However, there are a number of people out there that are debt educators who may not get licensed and who are providing this kind of activity either through the Internet or over the phone. We feel like it's important that they also get licensed. So one of our proposals is to pick up these debt educators as well. As I said, our goal under 2191 is to take a concept, debt management, and create this umbrella under which we have a single process for licensing these different categories of people who are essentially in the business of assisting consumers to manage debt that has become problematic for them. I mentioned debt consolidation agencies. Those are agencies in which people will negotiate on behalf of consumers to lower their payments. They'll either reduce the interest in part or they may get penalty fees reduced. However, they don't negotiate on principle, which is something that I sure makes sense to most people. The process requires them to go through some type of formal budget planning, make a determination of how much they can pay, and then amortize that payment over the course of up to 60 months or 5 years. So that this is a more practical or realistic way to pay things down. As I say, that does not reduce the principal, but it does help reduce some of the expenses that are owed. These debt consolidation agencies are licensed with us, and they're required to, their limitations under their license or registration to the amount they can charge in fees, how much they can receive on a monthly basis. They're required to hold all money in a trust account. They're required to have a surety bond. There are very specific requirements around the contracts, including a right of rescission and a right of cancellation, and there are very strong limitations around advertising. So we think that's a good model for using across the whole spectrum of debt management. Another category of businesses that we regulate are credit service organizations. Those are organizations that try to repair or improve consumers' credits, rating, often negotiating to defer payments on debt or to take on have new debt taken on behalf of the creditors. They also provide educational and
teach people on how to budget their process. In fact, most of the ones in Oregon that are true credit service organizations are involved in the educational piece. Again, we have all the restrictions I just talked about, or all the limitations that I just talked about with the debt consolidation agency. So we think we have a pretty good working model in place, but we think we need to bring these other entities under that working model. I just want to point out to the committee that the phenomenon of new and aggressively advertised debt management services is nothing new. Each one of the programs I've just described, the Debt Consolidation Agency in 1959 and the credit service organizations in 1993, were the product of the legislature hearing about aggressive efforts to promote services that had a number of elements that were very harmful to the public, or they were not getting the services they were promised, or they were promising more than they could deliver. And so the goal was, in both those legislative bills, to come in and structure how these services can be provided. And I think we're looking at the same thing now with debt settlement companies. And so I don't think this is anything unusual. I think it reflects the fact that as our economic times change and our delivery of information in the internet age, if you will, we have to constantly revise how we handle oversight of certain businesses. Now, there are different responses to this debt settlement issue, and you'll probably hear from another witnesses that will say, maybe we should just out and out ban debt settlement companies. They don't provide a lot of service. The society doesn't seem to gain a lot. And if you look at the MSN memo that I've submitted, you can see that at best it only serves maybe a very small niche of society. And so there's some question about whether that niche of society is necessarily needs to be provided those services. In fact, the other bill you're going to hear, 2368, would in effect preclude debt settlement companies in Oregon. And I think you, as the committee, have the opportunity to select that, make that policy decision. We offer one model, 2368 offers another model, and we just present both of those to this committee to discuss, for the discussion of what's the best model for Oregon. I will note, though, if you do preclude debt settlement companies per se and just say they can't do business in Oregon, without some type of enforcement mechanism, all you're going to do is preserve the status quo, because essentially right now there's no oversight of them and there's no real effective mechanism for overseeing them. Most of the people that are facing the challenges that need a debt settlement company are not going to be able to afford a lawyer and go after them if they feel like they've been wronged. The ability to reach out to somebody out of state makes it almost too costly. So at a minimum, if you do go down the path of looking at an outright ban, we would urge some consideration for coming up with an enforcement mechanism, potentially maybe including, under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, some type of mechanism to outlaw those practices. In addition, I've got a number of things that we think 2191 will address, and I'm not going to go through that because I know the committee has a full agenda. I'll just give you those areas, and then we can come back and talk about that when our bill, 2191, is ultimately amended. As I said, we want to come up with a single definition and a single registration program, so we have, if you will, a level playing field and some consistency both about fees charged and the amount of a surety bond, and that we all have these various companies operating under the same restrictions. Likewise, we want to make sure that if trust accounts are being used, that they're properly set up and that we oversee those trust accounts. As I said, we think it's very valuable to limit upfront fees and limit how much from the amount of funds or how the amount of the debt that is owed can be taken out as fees before any activity takes place. As I said, this we require written contracts, and we have the right of rescission and the right to cancel. And most importantly, we think that there's a disclosure factor that ensures that under the contract that certain information is provided to consumers on a regular basis. And I think that's particularly important to ensure that these the debt management companies are in fact sending the money to the creditors and the creditors are receiving it, so that you can track that and make sure that you are not in fact falling further behind or that you are not getting the services that you've contracted for. And then lastly, we would propose to put stringent limitations on advertising practices around deceptive statements, or at least require that any statement about past practices are subject to either some type of mechanism to determine that those are accurate. So if you make the representation that you've gotten the following settlements at a certain discount, so we've been able to settle X number of cases at 10% or 20 or 30 or whatever, there is some way for that to be evaluated by us as the oversight or regulatory agency. And lastly, we would ask to have certain enforcement tools that we use for other programs to make sure that if someone is licensed with us and they engage in wrongdoing, we can pull that license. As I mentioned, we're not here today to really give a detailed overview of 2191 because the bill that was has been introduced was a bill that was unfortunately didn't reflect where the department wanted to be. We are working with the Legislative Council right now to make amendments, and as I've had conversations with the chair and I've had conversations with a number of the stakeholders behind me, we realize that it's, we will probably want to make additional amendments. So we'll be working with the Legislative Council to try and address those things, and it's our understanding that sometime by the end of this month, early March, we should be back in front of this committee with the specific bill. So in closing, I just want to say that under the current economy and the rapid growth of the number of Oregonians who are facing mounting debt and uncertainty about where to turn and how to handle this problem, we believe that addressing this through an expansive bill of oversight is a good step in the direction of protecting Oregonians. With that, I'll conclude and happy to take questions from your committees.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
I have several questions and a comment, too, but is a lot of this considered just credit card debt? Is that we're talking a lot of it? Is that the type of credit you're talking about?
Chair Holdy and Representative Krieger, a lot of what the debt settlement companies do focuses on credit card. That's correct, credit card debt.
And you said earlier that you have to do a counseling before you can do bankruptcy?
But for the personal bankruptcy, Chapter 7, yes.
People have to do counseling before they get credit cards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I'm not aware of that, unfortunately.
Mr. Chair, if we did that, we wouldn't be here having this discussion because I see these people sending me, I'll bet you 5 to 10 a week credit card applications. They go to my grandkids that aren't even 18 yet. They go to college students who they know if they give credit to. Then they came back to our federal legislators a couple years ago complaining about the debt they couldn't collect and wanting the federal government to bail them out. That's where we need to go if you want to do something substantive in this committee, is have some type of criteria before you can apply for a credit card that you have to meet by your ability to pay it back, the job and the income. If you go to do a mortgage, they check and all that, but this credit card thing is getting to be, in my name, I mean, my opinion, obnoxious. I pay mine off monthly because I travel, I have to.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other people get in, and they get sucked in with these low rates, and all of a sudden they don't look. Guess what? It's up to 25-30% or more, and we complained about the payday loans last time. This is worse. Anyway, that's my opinion.
And you're sticking to it.
Yeah. Well, we have other bills coming. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, David. And, David, I see this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Correct?
Yes.
Thank you. So, David, would you be charging fees to people who would be licensed under DCBS?
Chair Holdy, Representative Tomei, that's correct. The people that, as we envision 2191, we would be licensing the panoply of the different companies I just mentioned, including right. The debt settlement companies.
Follow up. So couldn't you apply the fees to cover the cost to the general fund so there would be no referral to Ways and Means?
Chair Holdy, Representative Tomei, I would hope that would be the case. The fee would cover most of that, and to be honest, I'm a little embarrassed to say I caught flat-footed. I wasn't aware of the Ways and Means referral. But there, I'm sure there's a fiscal. I don't know that it has any impact on the general fund.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Apologies, Representative Gilliam.
Sorry.
Mr. Chapman, a question for you. Correct me if I'm wrong, but HB 2191 is modeled, if not exclusively, on the Uniform Debt Management Services Act. Is that right? Based on my read.
Chair Holby and Representative Barton, it probably parallels it. I wouldn't say it's modeled exactly on that. In fact, I understand there is a one out there. We have looked at the two, and I'd like to think we took the best of that plus the best of our own practices in what we're preparing in 2191. As I say, though, the current bill doesn't reflect exactly where we want to be. We intend to modify it even further.
Follow up. Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
One thing that would be very useful to me if and when the time comes is I would love to see, in particular, the points where it deviates. I tried to go through myself last weekend, but they're both fairly lengthy bills, mm-hmm. and I'd like to be able to think those through.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, if we haven't done it, I'm sure we will do it.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Mr. Chair, we are in... We can only do a public hearing on one bill at a time, right?
Not in my committee.
I should have known that. Are we in one now, or are we in two?
We're actually in both. I opened up both of them.
Ah, thank you. I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chapman, for being here and for your attitude toward this. I agree with you. The times that we're in dictate that we do something for folks that are being preyed upon, and we have a whole lot of folks that need some help. So sorting through that is not an easy job. I wonder if you could say a little more about, you made a reference to the cliche we all use, the stakeholders. When you talk about amendments and further discussion, where have we come from in terms of a work group, talking to folks, getting input from the business community and so forth?
I'll answer that for you. You're just a little bit ahead of the game here, but we have had some discussions with stakeholders, I personally and David Tapman, and we'll be establishing a work group shortly on this issue.
Are you volunteering?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just following up on Representative Tomei's inquiry about Ways and Means, just so I understand it, your proposal in 2191 would be fee-supported then? Is that correct?
Ms. Chair, Representative Cowan, that would be my expectation.
Okay.
Our expectation is that we will license these people and the fees would be generated to operate our enterprise.
Thank you.
And thank you. And I do understand that sometimes things go to Ways and Means, even if there is no fiscal to the general fund, but they do have to adjust accounts and the fees that go into those accounts and make sure they have the authority to spend that money in the accounts. And oftentimes it takes Ways and Means to accomplish that. But we don't know for sure why it has a referral at this point.
I was just trying to understand the funding source to make it happen.
So, Mr. Chair, while you're taking testimony from others, perhaps I can find out a little bit more about that, and if so, I can provide that. If not, we'll get back to you.
Yeah. Certainly. Any other questions? Representative Wingard.
Mr. Tapman, in your prepared remarks here, under the advertising practices, Section 7, you had suggested that one of the bill's goals would be to prevent these debt management service organizations from making deceptive statements. It's my understanding that that is already against the law, is it not, to make deceptive statements?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, it is probably under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but for our purposes, since we don't currently have regulatory oversight over them, we would want to. We have that authority for our debt consolidation agencies and our credit service organizations, and basically we would want that same authority over anyone we would license to avoid that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Just so I understand it, so there's a state law that I thought applied to everyone that prohibits making false or deceptive statements, but you say it only applies to certain companies, and in this case not these, and you're looking for the authority to hold them accountable under those same laws?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, I probably didn't express that clear enough. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act probably has broad limitations on false and misleading statements for anyone doing business with consumers in the state. My I'm not the expert here. Maybe Mr. Dubanovich can comment on that, but my understanding is that would probably apply here. However, if we're going to regulate them, we would want that express authority so that if they did such a thing, we would be able to take their license. That's the difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Mr. Tapman, I appreciate your coming forward and opening the door for a further conversation. We have several people left to testify, and so I want to move on and get some points of view from different spectrums. Again, I appreciate your testimony. So, eeny, meeny, miny, moe. I'd like to bring up Jan Amling and Debbie Pickering. You thought you were coming up last, didn't you?
They don't include this misleading statement to us.
Yeah.
What do you mean that's right? What does the campaign stuff look like, wouldn't it?
Welcome to our committee this afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
I'm Jan Amling with Money Management International, formerly known as Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Lynn Benton.
Thank you.
I'm Debbie Pickering, Executive Director at Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Coos Bay, Oregon.
Thank you. If you'd like to begin your testimony, whichever one wants to go first.
Sure. Chairman Holby and committee members, on behalf of Money Management International, which I'll refer to as MMI, doing business as Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Mid-Oregon in Eugene and Bend, and as MMI in Albany, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to provide comments regarding the recently proposed House Bill 2368 and House Bill 2191 as amended. These regard debt management. We appreciate your interest in our industry and willingness to receive input on how these changes would affect us on the ground. MMI is the largest full-service, tax-exempt, nonprofit credit counseling organization in the nation and operates over 125 in-person counseling offices in more than 20 states, including Oregon. I am an educator for MMI, and I work out of the Albany office. MMI provides professional guidance, financial guidance, counseling, community-wide education programs, and debt management assistance. We have been approved by the Executive Office of the U.S. Trustees, the EOUST, to provide both pre-filing bankruptcy counseling and pre-discharged bankruptcy education programs in all judicial districts, including Oregon. MMI is accredited by the Council of Accreditation after an extensive self-study and on-site review process. MMI is a member of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, the American Association of Debt Management Organizations, and the Association of Independent Consumer Credit Counseling Agencies, each of which have standards of operation as a condition of membership. In 2008, over 850,000 consumers contacted MMI looking for financial education and guidance on a wide range of issues, including credit card debt, budget problems, debt prioritization, housing counseling, bankruptcy counseling, and pre-discharge education, pre-discharge bankruptcy education. MMI is not in the business of providing debt settlement services. It is currently registered as a debt consolidation agency in Oregon, and MMI services do fall within the scope of the statute that regulates the debt consolidation industry. I have a few comments that we've put together on 2368 and 2191, as well as the issues that regard debt settlement. MMI shares concern with Oregon legislators and regulators regarding the debt settlement industry. Oftentimes, the industry offers incredible results using unconscionable marketing tactics, not disclosing the many risks associated with debt settlement. We understand that the Federal Trade Commission has this industry on its radar, and we should see enforcement actions against certain bad actors in the debt settlement industry sometime in the not-so-distant future. Nonetheless, we do think debt settlement does serve a niche of consumers who may have recently received a windfall and who understand the tax consequences of having debt forgiven by providing them an opportunity to reduce the amount of principal that they owe their creditors. Moreover, the EOUST in its process of finalizing regulations that require pre-filing credit counselors to disclose the availability of a 60-60 plan to all counseled clients. Pursuant to such plans, consumers work with their creditors to reduce the amount of principal that was added to their debt due to not paying interest over time. If a creditor does not grant this concession prior to the debtor filing bankruptcy, the court will treat this creditor unfavorably compared to other unsecured creditors who did allow for this reduction. 60-60 plans would fit a portion of the debt management service definition under House Bill 2368 and a portion of the debt management service organization definition under House Bill 2191. Moreover, from time to time on a debt management plan, consumers may also be able to settle their debts for pennies on the dollar. Where consumer protection issues begin to arise in the debt settlement industry is when consumers are encouraged to choose to cease paying their creditors and instead put away money via an escrow company affiliated with the debt settlement firm. The debt settlement firm begins to negotiate with the creditor who is not currently being paid, offering pennies on the dollar to settle the total obligation in full. Before this miraculous moment of settlement may occur, the client could be sued or have his credit report and score harmed by this lack of payments to the creditors. In a number of cases, not all creditors are willing to participate in this process. Therefore, a debtor may receive some relief, but also some serious harm to his ability to acquire credit in the future. Current Oregon statute...
Ms. Hamley?
Yeah.
I really appreciate this very thorough written testimony, and I'm wondering if perhaps you can maybe summarize it rather than reading it to us word for word, because
all right.
We all can read this later, and it's okay. Pretty thorough. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm kind of looking more for an overview or, you know, of what you have to say about these bills, and maybe you can describe to us a little bit more about the industry itself. Might be helpful. I don't mean to throw a curveball at you, but this is excellent testimony, and I intend to read every word of it, but I can do that later.
Okay. The agencies that I... First of all, you need to know that I started with Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Albany in 1979 after I got a master's degree in family economics. So I brought that agency up from doing everything by hand to having it become computerized and trying to deal as effectively as we could with consumers. So I've been with Consumer Credit Counseling Service for a whole lot of years. The industry has evolved over time, and it has evolved in ways that I am not particularly happy with because of the impact that the creditors have had on the way that we've done business. We used to be able to say, if you come to us, we've got JCPenney's, U.S. Bank, Meyer & Frank, Nordstrom's. We could go down a whole list of people that would totally stop all interest for people if they would come on our debt repayment plans. Unfortunately, we're not in the driver's seat. All we can do is offer to families the concessions that creditors will make to our whole industry. So they don't do anything special for me that they wouldn't do for the Coos Bay office, for instance. So the creditors, each creditor has their own arrangement in their mind of what they consider is a good business model for them and the concessions that they would make for families. These concessions have just eroded over time. So now a good concession is if somebody drops their interest rate to 16% or maybe 10% if you're really lucky. And because of the universal default, where if you're late to anybody else, then I have the right to jack up your interest rate to 27-29%, we can often, in our industry, get the creditor to go back down to his old interest rate, which seems wonderful because it's probably 10% less than what it had been raised up to. So our industry has changed over time. The funding that we used to receive from the creditors has severely eroded. A lot of the money that we ask the creditors for now, we have to do by way of grants. We spend a lot of time writing for grants to the major creditors to try and get money back into the agency to fund us. So that financial support has eroded, so we've had to ask families for help. In other words, if we're going to do work for you, you're going to have to give us some kind of money. ORS 697 has done a good job over time in terms of defining what kinds of fees we could take. We could take a $25 setup fee. We could take a fee of up to 15% of the money that the family gives us as our fee to work with them every month and send the money to the creditors. However, I have people that used to send $2,000 a month for their payments. We don't take a $300 fee. My office capped it at $35 a month. So while we could take 15%, most of us cap it at something that's much more reasonable than that. So the state did allow us to charge for educational services, and we can charge for the two aspects of the bankruptcy that the law requires. We're allowed to do those things. We can charge, I don't know if I said, for education. We can charge for counseling. In my office, if we charged for counseling, we did not charge the setup fee. They were both $25. So you either paid it in counseling or you paid it when we set you up. So that's the way that I ran my office when we were a small agency before I merged with MMI.
So just to be clear, you're a nonprofit organization that in the past has relied on grants and other ways to pay for your services because the customer couldn't afford your services.
The customer also paid a portion of our fees, probably about a third of the fees. The money that the creditors give us in those big grants, they want to think that that money is going out the back door to education where we're directly educating families, but yet we're having to use some of it in the one-on-one counseling session where we are also educating the consumer perhaps on how to better budget their money.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So I'm totally unfamiliar with your agency. So let's say that I have a debt of $50,000. How would I find you, number one? Can you tell me that?
If you start looking in the yellow pages under debt credit and debt services is where the bulk of everything that David Tatman has been addressing goes under, typically.
So how would I know, if I may have a how would I know you're different from some of these bad actors who are out here?
Hard to tell. It probably would be hard to tell from looking at the yellow pages. And a lot of the yellow page ads are so enticing. I mean, why would you want to pay 100% of your bill if somebody else is advertising, we can do it for 40, 50, 60%. I mean, why would you even want to bother to look at me if you thought you could have an easier way out with one of the other advertisements?
So then I have a little trouble then with your position that you have trouble with these bills. So why wouldn't you support these bills if it would weed out, hopefully, some of the bad actors?
There's a lot of the portions of the bill, the 2191, that we do support. There are some little specific parts of it that we have some issues with. It would appear that we cannot charge for education going forward, which we've been able to charge in the past if we wanted to. I'm not quite sure how to interpret the bill to decide whether or not we'd be able to charge for the bankruptcy pre-filing and pre-discharge services, and those, we lose money, even though we collect money from people for it. It's a loser for us, but we're still offering it to the people. We would not be able to charge for any counseling to the people. So that would be a slight negative to us, to not be able to charge for our services.
Am I correct in assuming that when there's this work group that you are, these folks are involved in that too, to have some input on
if
this?
If they're certainly willing, they will be.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Would you like to go ahead and give your testimony, please?
Hi. Excuse me. Debbie Pickering from Coos Curry office. We are a very small agency down on the South Coast. Jan joined the MMI, which is a large agency, so I'm here today to represent the small agencies out in the rural communities. I agree with what David has presented to you and with what Jan has said, and just want to follow that up with how we see it in the industry on the side of the consumer that comes through our door.
I gave you some statistics there from our office on how many people we served in 2008, what type of issues those were, and so forth, that I'll let you peruse at your convenience. But my big concern here is, as Jan said, that how are we as an accredited agency going to stay in business if we are not allowed to charge anything at all to the consumer? Right now we have a fee capped at $25 for a setup fee if we set up a debt management program for someone. I gave you copies of a couple of letters from clients that came in just this last week. These are current letters with complaints of companies that actually called them cold calls on the telephone asking them, do you have debt we can help you with? We can get your debt cut in half. You won't have to worry about collection calls from your creditors. They won't be bothering you anymore. We'll take care of everything for you. And then they charge them a $399 setup fee and then said that through a six to seven month process, while they were working with them to get them set up on a program, that there would be an additional $1,644 in fees that would be collected. And then, at that point, they turned them over to another entity, which I'm sure is another part of their own company, to take over the actual debt settlement part of the program. So they got all their fees and then turned them over to another company, which then took another $49 a month while they were putting money aside into this special services account to save up, to have enough money to give to their creditors to offer in settlements. In this process, the client is given instructions in writing as to how to write a letter of cease and desist to their creditors, not to contact them. They gave them mailing labels with instructions, do not tell the companies that you are sending their mail to us, but give the mailing address label to the company and have your mail diverted to us so that you won't be bothered by them, and but don't do a change of address at the post office. Just give this address to your creditors. Then you won't have to worry about this anymore. Well, then in the process, because the creditors can't contact the person and they're not able to talk to them over the phone, they are then being sued, their bank accounts are being garnished, their wages at work are being garnished, and now all of a sudden they're in panic mode, so they're looking in the phone book for additional help. And they finally find us in the Yellow Pages in the phone book, and yes, we say in there that we are accredited, we say that we're registered with the state, we're members of also the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and we put our criteria in there. And they finally decide, well, maybe I better go into a local office and talk to somebody face-to-face. So they come in and want us to wave the magic wand and make it all go away, and why didn't this work with this other company? What are they doing for us? And what they are telling them actually in their paperwork is, be patient, because the longer you wait, the better deal we can make for you to get this settled. They guaranteed them that at the end of up to 3 to 4 years, it may take that long, but that at that time they could make a better settlement and that they would never pay more than what their original debt was. Now, where does that help the consumer? And so I'm here today to tell you there needs to be legislation. There needs to be legislation to protect the consumer. There needs to be legislation that allows us as an accredited agency to survive in this field in order to help the consumers in our communities. And I'm just here to tell you, we just hear horror story after horror story of what's happening out there because of the phone calls people get, the advertising that you see that we can't afford to do to counteract. And so the only way to counteract that is through some type of legislation to control it. And we worked very hard years ago. I've been working with Consumer Credit Counseling since 1977 and helped start the agency down there in Coos Kerry. And I've been the executive director since 1983. And as Jen said, there have been many, many, many changes. And with the economy the way it is now, there are a lot of people really hurting. And it's not just the low-income people that we're seeing. We're seeing people who are losing their jobs, who are having pay cut reductions, hours cut. And as you'll see on there, I was shocked when I went through and saw that the actual average income of the person we're seeing right now is $63,000 a year. The average we used to see was maybe $20,000. We are seeing a lot of people in our area that are making over $100,000 a year and are still being hit by this bad economy and coming to us for help. Now, we don't charge anything at all at this point for counseling. The law has allowed us to charge a minimum fee for counseling. We appreciate that because we can see the day when we won't have grants to cover that, to where we are going to need to be able to charge a small fee for counseling. We also cap our fees, $25 for the setup fee. We cap our monthly fees at $50, even the ones that we're sending out payments for up to $2,000, $3,000 a month to these credit card companies that are, you know, they come in with $80,000 and $100,000 in credit card debt. The most credit cards I ever cut up was 38. It's ridiculous. But we are not one of those companies that advertise, if you have $5,000 to $10,000 in credit card debt, we will help you. We help the consumer with any kind of debt that they have. We help them with everything. And these other companies out there are not. They don't care what that individual is dealing with, how they're going to continue to survive on a budget, and how they're going to learn to get through this process. All they care about is getting those initial upfront fees and then turning them over to somebody else to pick up the pieces and deal with it, and then knowing that the averages are that they're not going to be able to follow through with that because they're going to panic when they get sued. We see people, they're coming in and filing bankruptcy when they get to that point because it's already gone too far before they found us.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Very compelling stories, and it's just disgusting, but I'm assuming you're supportive of these bills.
I am supportive of legislation. It needs some work. And as it is written right now, I could not totally support it.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't mean to interrupt.
That's fine.
I have some questions.
I could talk all day about this.
Okay. thank you for being here. And I particularly want to know, if we can just back up for a second, mm-hmm. in your role down at Coos Kerry, the Coos Kerry area, because I note you helped 2,158 people in 08. Do you have a, even if it's ballpark, how has that number gone up since 07 or 06, for instance?
The number has been floating around 1,600 to 1,700, and in 2008 it has jumped up. We're seeing too many more people who we cannot set up any kind of a program for them to help them with their creditors. They're too far gone mm-hmm. for their income.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
In addition to that, mm-hmm. then, I mean, obviously we've got to look at the regulation and
yes.
and weeding out the, and I really resent the bad actor reference, but we've got to weed out the bad guys. And but what I'm getting at is, wouldn't you agree that in addition to that, we need more folks doing this, whether it's the nonprofit side or in the industry itself, because this is only going to get bigger. I mean, folks that are actually helping people, obviously. Your agency would you say you're maxed out, or do you have growth plans?
Well, right now our staff is pretty maxed. We're a very small agency. We cannot generate the funding to hire more staff. If we could, we would do even more. But in our area, we feel that it's adequate for right now. But the problem we're seeing is that there, with technology the way it is, a lot of people, they're fearful of that, admitting face-to-face with somebody they've gotten themselves in trouble. We stress our confidentiality, so we see people from all walks of life. You'd be surprised who we see. But many times all they want to do is go on the internet or get on the telephone and do a quick job. And that's what a lot of these companies out there say, that, you know, we can help you with your debt in 10 minutes, you know, and you won't have to worry about the calls anymore. You know, we can get this done for you. And it's because they don't care about the consumer. We spend a minimum of an hour and a half with everybody that comes through our door for counseling. And these companies say they can do it in 10, 15 minutes.
One quick last follow-up, if I can, Mr.
Follow-up.
Just to Representative Krieger's point, do you have an opportunity in the midst of all of that to do some preemptive, education of young people who are coming up to the point where they're eligible for these for credit cards?
We go into the schools, and I talk to seniors, and I try to put the fear of God in them. You know, I tell them the horror stories that can happen and what they need to watch out for. I actually have a video that shows a young girl going to college and getting her first credit card, you know, and what happens to her following that and the results of it. And that is where we spend a big share of our time, is in trying to educate the community in the schools. I go to service clubs even and talk to them about things like identity theft, because that affects their finances. We talk to groups. We go to Head Start parents. We go out and talk to everybody we possibly can to educate them on the wise use of credit and how to avoid these things.
Oh, I could have used you last week in my flesh.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony today and your participation in this you know, what you do out there for a lot of people, and hope that you're able to follow this process along with us and helping us draft some legislation that does address the problems without putting undue burden on those that are doing the right thing in this industry. So again, I appreciate all you've done. Appreciate your testimony, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, I'd like to have Mark Giemond, I know I didn't say that right, and Julie Wisely. It's probably Giemond or something.
If I could tell you the number of times, it's different pronunciations, that'd be good. It's actually Giemond. I'm Mark Giemond, Executive Director of the American Association of Debt Management Organizations. We're the largest trade association for the credit counseling industry. I'm pleased to have Julie here. She's one of our members, and Jan with MMI. MMI is also a member of ours. We represent about 70% of your licensed or registered debt consolidating agencies in the state. So we're very familiar with the laws that is in place right now and with both of these bills. And I just kind of want to go through some of the details of them and where we stand on certain positions. As you know, the state currently regulates debt consolidating agencies. The definition for debt consolidating agency is pretty much your traditional credit counseling definition. It's agencies that receive and disperse funds from consumers on a regular periodic basis so that at the end of a period, usually about a maximum of 60 months, that they can fully amortize and pay off their bills in full.
Credit counseling is a time-tested program. It's been around for 50 years or more. It's a known way for people to get out of debt. Your state allows several different varieties of debt consolidating agencies to work. You allow for-profit and non-profit. You have over 50 agencies that are currently licensed in the state as for-profits and non-profits. And I got to tell you, your licenses or your registries are doing a great job. The state is doing a great job in the enforcement and the regulation of those agencies as well. I think the reason that we're here today is not about your licensees, and I can pretty much assure you that if you looked at the complaints the consumers are bringing, your licensees are not being the ones named. These are your problems right here. Eliminate 50 to 75% of your debt. Wipe out 50 to 75% of your debt. Eliminate 70% of your debt without bankruptcy. Erase 50% of your debt. Get rid of your debt for pennies on the dollar. This is not credit counseling, and this is not even legal. I believe the question was posed earlier, though, who gets to regulate this? Currently, the department does not have regulatory authority over debt settlement companies or others outside of credit counseling. They can only go after debt consolidating agencies. I think you want to give your authority to the department for regulation over other entities that they're asking for. And as well, I'd strongly recommend that you look at the long-arm statute that you provide with your attorney general to go after bad players. They said it's not your registries that you're looking at. It's folks that are outside. They're making these promises, and there's absolutely no way for them to fulfill these promises. And they're preying on desperate, desperate, financially distressed consumers right now. The way credit counseling works is somebody who's in distress goes to an agency. They sit down usually with a certified counselor, which under most state laws is a requirement, and I would propose that here. They do a thorough written budget analysis, which is also a requirement of most of the state laws. The counselor goes through those activities with the individual or the family and looks at their numbers to make sure things work. They need to determine, too, if in fact the proposed debt management plan, the repayment program, will benefit the consumer. And that is an element I would throw in the law as well at this opportunity. And then lastly, that plan that's proposed that's going to benefit somebody, they have to have the ability to fund that plan. They have to be employed or have income coming in or some ways of repaying their creditors. Again, in credit counseling, an individual repays 100% of their debt back to the creditor. They're not settling anything for what they don't owe. The creditors are being paid in full, but they're given the breathing room, a little amount of space that they need with concessions, things like reduced interest rates or reduced late fees or over-the-limit fees, giving the consumer the time to get back on their feet and make those payments back to the creditors. The law right now currently has, as I said, for-profit and non-profit agencies under the law. They are registered. Both of those types of agencies are committed to the fee limits that are in the law, of a $25 setup fee and a $15 maximum, 15% maximum monthly charge. That applies to everybody who is registered, regardless of their tax status. I would add, I think the committee needs to have some guidance and briefing later on as to how nonprofits truly receive their funding these days. There were major, major changes to nonprofit tax-exempt law with the Pension Protection Act of 2006. It changed how traditional credit counseling is going to receive its money. In the past, creditors were able to give a large percentage of the funding of the credit counseling agency and support it that way. The agencies could ask for voluntary contributions from consumers. The consumers could give what they thought was appropriate. Under the federal law right now, nonprofit agencies are not able to receive voluntary contributions. If there's any question about what I just said, tax-exempt agencies are not able to receive voluntary contributions from consumers to support their activities. They are also limited to the amount of total revenue that they can receive from creditors and from consumers of the total debt management plan. So while cutting funding mechanisms and limiting things to nonprofits may have been a good idea years ago, the nonprofit tax-exempt model has changed significantly, and I believe the committee needs to address the changes in federal law to make that consistent with any proposals that would be in the state. The two bills that we're looking at, 2368, I believe is overreaching as it's drafted right now. The basic problem that we have with it as an organization is that it would prohibit any activities except for a nonprofit agency and would not allow the nonprofit agency to charge at all for those services. Nonprofit agencies, just like any other agencies, have to pay their personnel, pay for the roof over their head, the electricity, paper, everything. So cutting out their funding mechanism from the consumer, while they've lost it under federal law, will leave these agencies with no ability whatsoever to provide services to the residents of the state. We've met with the chairman. We've met with the department. I think everybody is cognizant of this at this point. We'll go through that with the working groups. I'd like the committee to have a sense, though going away from this, as to what for-profit and nonprofit credit counseling is. For-profit credit counseling is not debt settlement. For-profit and nonprofit credit counseling are the exact same thing, and they are a regulated activity under your state law, and this state has done a very good job of regulating its registries, and there have not been problems. I believe the problems that came about to inspire 2368 were consumer problems that were dealing with illegal agencies anyway, and there's no way to stop that unless you actually go after them. The department doesn't have the authority to go after those types of agencies or these, and I think that needs to be given to them. So if you want to solve your problems, it's not going after your registrants and those agencies that are doing a good job now and have been doing a good job for years. It's to go after the illegal players, to get a long-arm statute, grab them where they are, and either go after them civilly or throw in some criminal penalties. Thank you.
Thank you for that thorough testimony. We'll move on to Julie.
Thank you. Thank you for hearing me today. My name is Julie Wisely, and I'm a branch manager in Eugene for Debt Reduction Services. We are a licensed nonprofit credit counseling agency with 13 full-serve face-to-face counseling offices nationwide. We've been providing credit counseling and education services in Oregon since 1999. Mr. Chairman, we are legally operating a registered agency in the state of Oregon and operate in your district, and we proudly served your constituents for many, many years. I'm here today to give information on what services, debt reduction services, an Oregon licensee provides to debtors seeking solutions to aid them in managing their debt properly. As a credit counseling agency licensed and compliant in much of the nation, a provider of pre-bankruptcy counseling and post-debtor education pursuant to the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Act of 2005, we have a bona fide insight into the financial challenges faced by Oregon debtors as well as debtors nationwide. Our mission is to promote financial responsibility in our clients and community members nationwide. We accomplish this through educational programs, counseling, and personalized services. We thus empower individuals to develop and use positive budgeting skills and effective spending behaviors, use credit wisely, and prevent, manage, and eliminate consumer debt. For those of you that are unfamiliar with credit counseling, I would like to give you a summary of events that a consumer may experience if they choose to take advantage of our services. Through a variety of ways, an individual learns of our services we offer and contacts us face-to-face at our offices or via telephone or internet to receive financial education, budgeting, pre-bankruptcy counsel, or post-bankruptcy debtor education classes or credit counseling. Our certified and bonded counselors assess each individual's situation by asking questions about their current financial status and habits. At DRS, this process begins by finding out the root cause of the financial difficulty a client is experiencing. For some, financial problems are a result of a life-changing event, such as divorce, death, job loss, poor health, or changes in the local and national economy. We also see many people who are experiencing a combination of these problems that inhibit their ability to effectively manage their finances. Investigating past problems as well as potential future financial hardships can help the counselor make appropriate suggestions to help consumers form positive financial habits. When an individual attends a consultation with a DRS counselor, a complete debt analysis using credit reports as one of many tools is conducted to aid in providing a clear understanding of the client's overall indebtedness. DRS counselors look past the basic criteria or profile of a client and do their best to ensure the suggested course of action is appropriate. One of the courses of action could be a debt management program or a DMP. A good candidate for this service has to have the income or earning potential to make regular payments on a DMP. A DMP is a debt repayment plan agreed upon by an individual's creditors that debt reduction contacts on their behalf, in which monthly payment plans are proposed and a variety of interest rates or payment concessions are made by their respective creditors. Clients should actively participate in the debt management process by making regular payments to be sent out to their creditors each month, and they can monitor their own statements and see the progress as they consistently pay down the actual debts owed. Most debt management plans take 36 to 60 months for complete amortization. Fees for Oregon consumers are $25 to enroll and $10 per creditor with a cap of 15% or $50 maximum. In some cases, an individual's financial situation may be as such that they can't afford the debt management program fees. If so, debt reduction will waive those fees to ensure the client's success on the program.
It also may be Chair, could I ask a question? You keep using the phrase debt reduction. Is that the name of your company?
Yes, Debt Reduction Services.
Thank you.
Continue.
It may also be appropriate to suggest that a debtor seek another type of professional counseling, explore supplemental income possibilities, obtain help from family or friends, or consult with a bankruptcy attorney. Many that contact our offices don't know the difference between credit counseling and debt settlement. At DRS, we, as well as many others in the industry, try to educate them on the difference and ask them to ask questions and, you know, seek the credentials of anybody they're working with financially. We at Debt Reduction don't negotiate settlement offers or hold client funds or recommend that they stop having communications with their creditors. Nor do we believe it's recommended that they do that. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you. And either one of you can address this, or I can have David Tapman address it later. You both mentioned the state law as far as the debt management type of services and credit counseling you give. You're allowed a $25 setup fee, and then you can have a monthly charge of 15%, I assume, of the unpaid debt.
Of the monthly payment the consumer makes.
Of the monthly payment the consumer makes. Okay. And the cap has been mentioned several times by some that have, you know, one has a $25 cap. You mentioned a $50 cap. Is that, I'm not aware that there's a cap in law. Is there an actual cap that's required by law?
The Oregon statute does not provide for a cap on that. It's simply 15%. At the discretion of the agency if they want to charge the full amount. But yes, under current law, they could charge the full 15% of the payment. The trend in most other states at this point is to where the percentage amount is permissible, is to have it as a permissible amount up to a certain point. And most states right now are going towards 15% to a maximum of $75.
Thank you. That's helpful. Questions? Representative Tomei?
Is that per month?
It is a monthly maintenance fee included in the client's payment.
15% of the total debt per month.
With a maximum of
$50. Of the total payment, I believe you said.
Correction, that would be 15% of the monthly payment, not of the total debt.
Thank you.
We'd have problems with 15% of the total debt every month.
I know.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Thankfully, I'm really not very familiar with this service, and I'm kind of glad I don't understand it fully because I haven't happened to need it. But so help me with the concept that you said you don't hold the creditor's funds, but yet they make a monthly payment every month. So could you just kind of walk me through how it works, that okay. They pay you and then you pay the creditors?
Client enrolls in our program, they will make a monthly payment to us. We set up their creditors with a reduced interest rate. Oftentimes when you reduce the interest rate, you can get the payment lowered. So we have a proposed payment amount that's agreed upon by their creditors. The client then makes a payment to us. We disperse it out to their creditors each month. and they continue to get their statements so that they can make sure that their interest rates have been reduced and their okay. payment is being posted. And
I wanted to make sure I understood
yeah,
you correctly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But to clarify that, you're not keeping a separate account that where any leftover monies or anything goes for the...
Mr. Chair, if I could add on to that, I would propose that in your working group you look at a measure to require that when funds are received by an agency, that it has a mandatory disbursement schedule of, say, 3 days or not more than a week, but that you put into the law that an agency is not going to hold those funds. Your good players don't do that, but if somebody finds a way to get a loophole, they will.
Thank you. Further questions? I really appreciate you coming forward and seeking me out on this issue and pointing out the broad overreaching bill that I proposed as opposed to the agency bill. But I'm happy to work with you in trying to make sure that we can draft something that is legitimate and addresses the issues that I see and I think perhaps other members of this committee see as well. So thank you very much.
Sure.
And before you leave today, I want to make sure that you leave your name and contact information with my committee administrator so as to enable you to participate remotely if need be in our endeavor to come up with language.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Next up, we have Wesley Young, Heather Carmichael, and Jenna Keenan.
Good afternoon. Actually, let you guys sit together.
And if you would introduce yourself for the record before you begin.
Good evening, or good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and the Honorable Committee. My name is Wesley Young. I'm the Legislative Director for the Association of Settlement Companies. You'll hear me refer to us as TASC. Sorry, I'm T-A-S-C.
I'm Jenna Keenan, the Executive Director of the United States Organizations for Bankruptcy Alternatives, or USOBA, and I appreciate your time today, Chair and Committee, for taking the time to hear our thoughts and our views on this topic.
And I am Heather Carmichael, also from Texas, and I am the Legislative Chair of the USOBA organization as well. And our company, Credit Solutions, is one of the largest and oldest organizations in the country that does debt settlement.
Thank you. And you may choose whoever wants to go first.
Do you mind if I start?
Go ahead.
Thank you again. I thought I'd start by giving you a little bit of background about my association, who I'm here on behalf of. We represent about 180 debt settlement companies nationwide. The purpose of our association is to create and enforce standards for our industry or for our membership to promote good business practice and to promote consumer protections. We have mandatory disclosures and mandatory standards that we require each member to abide by. And then we self-regulate by having an independent third party pose as a consumer and call each member and to make sure that they are indeed abiding by our standards. We also have a third party company who monitors. I know there's a lot of concern about advertising. This third party company goes to each company's website, which is a large part of the marketing that our companies do, to make sure that the website itself does not breach any of our standards and is fair of the services that are being being provided. You know, as in this day and age, debt management is a necessary option for consumers. You have Fortune 500 companies who can't even afford to pay back their debts and are struggling to manage their finances. The very creditors that our debtors owe money to are getting government bailouts of billions of dollars. For a consumer, oftentimes, debt settlement may be the closest thing that they will get to receiving some kind of bailout. In a nutshell, what debt settlement is the payback of less than the full amount of debt, but yet in full satisfaction of that debt. So, for instance, if the consumer owed $10,000, the debt settlement company may negotiate that debt down to $5,000, and the creditor may accept that as full satisfaction of the debt. And I'll go into in a little bit more detail as to exactly how that process works. But I also heard today a lot of criticism about our industry and a lot of complaints about our industry. And I think, unfortunately, on your end, you hear mostly about those complaints. But I want to assure you that we receive on a daily basis numerous testimonials that and feedback as to how much of a benefit our services provide to the consumers. Because I think academics, consumer groups, and even the FTC agree that there are many consumers who can't afford to pay back their debts in full. That without some concession, not on the interest, but on the principal, that that they will not be able to afford to pay back their debts. And I think you heard from Ms. Amley today that the creditors are not working with the credit counseling folks quite as much as they used to. That nowadays, a 16% concession rate is a good concession. But for many people, that's not affordable. If you were to pay back your entire debt plus 16% interest, that's a lot more money than planning on paying back maybe half that. So we serve a niche that would not otherwise be served, and we serve consumers who would not otherwise have an option in dealing with their debt. And the most dramatic of these testimonials are people who write back and say, you literally saved my life, or I was just about to end it all, and you guys helped me through it, and I wouldn't be able to do this otherwise. I volunteer for the association, but I am also serving, I am with a debt settlement company, and we have had consumer or client service reps call the police because they were so concerned about the well-being of the consumer that they may actually harm themselves. And when the clients call back and say, why did you call the cops? It's because we were concerned. I mean, these, we have a very, and I'll tell you again a little bit more about this, but we have a very work-intensive model. We have constant communication with the consumer. So we have an idea of what the consumer is going through, and we're able to kind of keep in touch with the struggles that they're having, and we can help with those problems. Who is enrolled in our programs? Really, if you take a cross-section of your community, those are the people we have in our programs. Now, I actually will, with a caveat, I think there's a misperception that we service mainly lower-income citizens. And that's not really the case, because I think the average contract that enrolls in debt settlement plan is roughly between $20,000 or $25,000 and $30,000 or $35,000. So these are people who are able to afford credit, who obviously borrowed money and had to have a decent income. So we actually don't service that many of the lower end or lower income folks. We have lawyers in our program, doctors in our program. We even have, sadly enough, financial planners in our program. But one of the distinctions between, or I'd like to go through some of the distinctions between what we do and what the credit counseling folks do. Obviously, the negotiation of the balance of the debt down is a primary difference. We are not funded by the creditors. We do not receive any fair share or contribution from the creditors. Our fees come entirely from the consumer. This is a membership requirement, and sometimes I forget that I'm not talking about the industry at large, because we represent probably about 35% of the industry. But our membership is required that we do not hold the funds. We do not receive and hold the funds of the consumer. We do not have a trust account. The consumer saves the money either in their own bank accounts, or sometimes they set up a third-party account with a bank that they still have exclusive control over. But we do not have access to those funds. And lastly, we do not have any prearranged deals with the creditors, for the most part. When a consumer enrolls in our program, there is no pre-struck deal that says you're going to get X percent off your debt or X percent off in interest of your debt. Debt settlement is not for everybody. One of the requirements we have is that in our standards is that you must pre-screen your consumers. number one, you have to do a budget. You have to make sure that they can afford the program, obviously, with the and you know, in today's market, it's, you know, we actually have, I think people assume that you've got a much larger pool of consumers to offer services to, but actually, since a lot of people are losing jobs, those people fall off of our ability to service them because they can't afford to even set aside money in savings to pay off these debts. But they also should have a hardship, a reason why they got into the position they're in. If they can afford to pay their debts, if they can add money to their minimum payments to pay off those debts, then they should. We refer people to credit counseling if they're appropriate for credit counseling. We've had credit counselors refer consumers to our program because they couldn't afford their program. So our services are not for everybody. And there probably is some overlap if you look at bankruptcy and credit counseling. There may be some overlap that we have with those groups. But we certainly service a niche of consumers who can't afford or don't have any other options otherwise without us. What we think is needed, and we think that 2191 deals with, is there has to be some standards. We feel like as an association we've done that. We've imposed some standards, but it needs to be done statewide. We agree that there need to be standards. Secondly, there needs to be accountability. And we know that a licensing process will provide that accountability. If 2191 passed, and I understand there's a work group in place as well, we're really looking forward to working together with the department to show them what we have done in setting up our standards, the disclosures that we require be made to each consumer before they enroll in a program so they understand what the plan is, what the risks are, what the benefits may be. But we think that our experience in understanding the unique needs of debt settlement and consumer protection within that service, we think that we have an expertise in that. We'll be happy to share that with the department. I took some notes during some of the other testimony. I don't know if now is an appropriate time to address those or if I should wait for the for questions to come from the panel.
Why don't we hear the rest of the testimony first? As we're running into time crunches, I'd like to give you all an opportunity, and there's still more testimony beyond yours.
As I said earlier, I'm Jenna Keenan. I represent USOBA, who has more than 140 member companies. We're the oldest association in this industry, formed in 2004. Much of what Wesley said, our organization does the same, and I think that there needs to be a distinction made here today. Mark Guyman did hold up some horrifying ads that are out there on the internet. They're out there on television, on the radio. Nothing like that has anything to do with what we promote or what we represent. It's deplorable to us, just as it's deplorable to you and to him. We'd like to for that to cease and desist just as much as you would. Bad actors, no offense, also give us a hard time. We have a very difficult time representing an industry coming into a committee like this when all you hear is a very small fraction of terrible players in this industry that has muddied it for us all. As far as slinging mud, we choose not to do that. There certainly is a niche for all of these financial options, and as the debt issues grow, those options are likely to expand and overlap even further. No industry is perfect. Ours isn't. None of the other industries that talk today are. We're not even coming close to trying to sway you that we have something figured out that you guys don't know. What I will tell you, we have one small piece of, as you know, there are very little centralized statistics. There's not one place we're all registered. But what we did do is perform a study of over 20,000 consumers actively seeking debt assistance. 20,000 Joe Blow consumers. What we found was actually better than we even anticipated as far as statistically speaking, and then worse at the same time. 29.9% of the consumers that were surveyed over a 5-year period
couldn't pay their own bills, couldn't meet the minimums, nor add anything to it. They could not qualify for or subsidize a credit counseling or debt management plan program, and they did not qualify for or were trying to move heaven and earth to avoid bankruptcy. That's 29.9% of all of your constituents and consumers who are trying to find a way out. They cannot do it this way, cannot do it this way. That leaves them with two options. Pray for Aunt Fanny to die, leave them a windfall of money, or wait until their situation is so dire that they finally can qualify for the bankruptcy protection that they're seeking. For us, these options are dismal at best. What we're here to do is absolutely support the effort to regulate. Again, you make our lives easier. We all have standards. Our organization, TASC, has standards. We have standard disclosures. We have requirements. We have accreditation. We monitor our member sites. So keep in mind when you're thinking about regulating this industry that you don't regulate it targeting criminal behavior only, because the last thing I want to see is a law that is so prohibitive and so onerous that even ethical companies can't abide by it. And you can bet the unethical companies are not going to be applying for licensure in your state, period, no matter how great you write that bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson Halvey, and all the committee members for allowing me to address you today as well. Again, my name is Heather Carmichael, and I'm the legislative chair for USOBA, as well as VP of Legislative Affairs for Credit Solutions, one of the oldest and most experienced companies in the debt settlement space. Now, debt settlement has actually existed since the time of the Sumerians. They just used to beat you with sticks and steal your goat. Okay. Then in the 1960s, you began to see more regulation hit a segment of the industry. So this is not necessarily a new problem. Generally speaking, throughout all time periods of history, about 5% of people get into financial hardships and need a true financial advocate. So debt's always been around. In short, you have to have options for Oregon constituents who are in financial turmoil and those that are looking for alternatives to bankruptcy. So I'd like to quote for you very quickly one of my favorite experts in this area, and her name is Elizabeth Warren, professor of law at Harvard University. And this is a short quote from a paper that she wrote in 2003 as she began to look at all of the National Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005 as that legislation came down the track. Here's what Elizabeth said. If middle-class families are not able to discharge their short-term debt, there will be no escape but to leave the workforce, or more precisely, to exit the legal economy for the underground. Just as deadbeat parents have avoided child support, families and single parents will be forced to run from their debts. They will no longer be tax-paying citizens. They will retreat into a 21st century debtor's prison, becoming part of a growing shadow economy. It was the fear of losing the productive energy of our citizens that led the founding fathers to include a fresh start for all Americans in the Constitution. And I'd be happy to send you a copy. This is from Consumer Bankruptcy Issues Summary, Harvard Law School, January 7th, 2003. So you know your own state statistics very well, and I hope you do not hit double-digit unemployment rates, but if you even look nationally, in December of 08 alone, we cut 577,000 workers from payrolls. That is the most cuts since 1945. So if you look also at bankruptcy filings increasing 33% to over a million filings in 2008, those U.S. Labor Department statistics are pretty telling. If you look at the given economic turmoil, it's clear to see that there are several niches of customers to fill, and at the end of the day, debt settlement, we believe, fits one niche in particular the best, and that are people that are the true trauma types. So if your kid gets cancer right now, you need a financial advocate. You're going to be out there choosing to pay your heat bills or health care. And when that happens, at the end of the day, no matter how good or responsible of a person that you are, you're going to put food and diapers on a credit card. You'll never be able to pay back that full amount of debt on any sort of debt payment plan, ever, your entire life. So if you look at a couple of stats that I pulled from our company quickly from Oregon, and we've got over 200,000 customers that we've helped nationwide. So in total, we manage about $2 billion in debt. And of the over 1,000 Oregon customers, I've had 68 customers that I have tracked to date that have completed the program successfully, and 446 that we've turned away because they were not a fit for debt settlement in our particular program. The average completion, if you do a histogram of all of those customers that have successfully completed, because again, this is a fairly new industry, the average was 22 months to completely get out of debt and exit the program and then go on to do credit repair or those other options, because this is a much better option than filing bankruptcy. Bankruptcy, I believe, has become sort of the new A that gets stamped onto your forehead. It's one of those things that is going to prop up or going to hurt our ability to prop up the economy. So if you have to file or check, I have filed bankruptcy on every job application going forward, and you limit your ability to buy a house for the next 10 years, that's a very serious hurt to our economy going forward. So potentially the thousands of Oregon consumers that could be left in financial ruin, if there are no other debt options than bankruptcy or consumer credit counseling, that's what we're looking to avoid. You've actually got an industry coming to you and to many other states, so we would love to make Oregon, sort of the example going forward for other states and other attorney generals as well. Everyone's sort of watching Mr. Kroger from what I hear. So there's no one perfect solution or answer to those ubiquitous little plastic credit cards. There is a bigger question at hand: what kind of band-aids can you put in place, and how do you regulate these companies? So we're asking for licensing, for bonding, for insurance requirements, for additional disclosure requirements to customers, and all of those different marketing practices as well that a lot of our industry associations have already begun the accreditation programs. So our company is ISO 9000 and USOBA certified. We have won the J.D. Powers Award for Customer Call Center and the Stevie Award for Customer Service. It is not a perfect program. It's not a perfect industry, but Home Depot in 2008 got 6,000 consumer complaints with the Better Business Bureau. I mean, they sell nails. How do you mess up selling nails? So that's the business that we're in. We are asking for regulation that is pro-business and pro-consumer, and we are looking to make a fair profit. So if we can help on the working committee and talk about additional licensing requirements, disclosures, or any of those other protective consumer pieces, please let us know, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. A couple of you have both mentioned that you have standards for your association. I was wondering if I could get a copy of what those standards are that you require as far as your standards of practice, what's allowable, what's not. And a question, does the federal government regulate your industry? Do you have licensing or any kind of regulation over the from the federal government?
Mr. Chair, the federal government does not directly regulate our industry, unlike credit repair, where they do have a federal law. We do fall under, and I think Representative Wingard mentioned this, kind of the deceptive trade practices, marketing, general laws, and the FTC has enforced those laws on just general marketing practices, but there isn't anything specific for debt settlement.
And does your industry have, like the others have expressed, a maximum setup fee, a maximum monthly payment amount, or a cap on what the maximum amount is?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. There are some states that have specifically regulated our industry. Idaho has regulated us last year. They set the cap at 20%. Colorado, 20% of the outstanding debt, or 20% of the debt at the time of enrollment into the program. So at the principal amount of debt, not including, like for instance, in Oregon today, the 15% fee that is charged by the credit counseling folks is charged on money that is paid to the provider for payment to the creditor, which would include interest. So the 20% is at the time of enrollment, so it doesn't include any interest that might accrue later on.
So it's 20% of the amount owed by the creditor? Is that what you're saying?
Owed by the debtor.
Or owed by the debtor, yeah, to the creditor.
And then Colorado has...
So are these, I guess my question is, does your association have have these limits and dollar amounts set out in their standards for their members?
We don't have specific fee caps as an association. We have we're actually just about to come out with some guidelines as to how to best structure your fee and how much to charge.
Mm-hmm.
We just put in our standards that they must be fair and reasonable.
So, and you'd made mention about trust accounts. Do your companies deal with trust accounts?
We do not have trust accounts because we do not. One of the requirements is you do not hold the money. So, in order to have a trust account, the money must be paid to the provider. They deposit that in the.
So, do you partner with other organizations or corporations or individuals that do set up those trust accounts for you?
We have. There is a couple companies out there, or bank agents, I guess, that have dealt with our industry and our consumers and understand the issues. We're not compensated by them. We have no interest in them. This is simply a service that helps the consumers. We found that the consumer actually does better when the money is separated from their usual spending bank account because they become more disciplined. So we recommend that they do set up some account apart from their regular bank. These other banks do have, they're called special purpose accounts, but the consumer maintains exclusive control over them, exclusive access to them. But it's just it's like a separate bank account that they control. And I'd be happy to provide you some information, some sample contracts that the consumers have with that bank or bank agent. In other legislative, in other states, those companies have offered to come out and talk to the legislators or talk to the regulators about how they do things to make sure that you're comfortable with that setup.
And one other thing I'm interested in is any kind of standards you have for pre-screening clients to make sure they have the ability to pay off their debt before you engage in charging them fees for your services. I'd be interested to know what those pre-screening models look like, what exactly you're looking for when you make those sorts of determinations. Other questions of the committee?
Yeah.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you help us understand what advice is then given to your clients with regard to continuing their relationship with their creditor? Are they? We've heard it suggested that creditors not be contacting their or debtors not be contacting their creditor during this period of time. I'm trying to figure out that process.
I believe USOBA has the same standards as we do on this, but our standards are very clear. You cannot advise the consumer not to pay his or her debts. On the other hand, our program really is designed for folks who can't afford to continue to pay their debts. For instance, we had a consumer who was a superintendent of the school district, was doing very well, but his minimum payments to his creditors were $8,000 a month. And that's just the minimum payment that he had to make every month. He had taken a home equity loan out to try and keep up. He had borrowed against other credit cards. He had borrowed against his 401k to try and keep up. He simply could not afford to continue to do that. He also couldn't afford, he didn't qualify for bankruptcy because he made too much money. He couldn't qualify for credit counseling because the payments would have been close to $8,000 a month under a credit counseling plan, so he came to us. But we do not advise consumers not to pay their debts. And I think one of the criticisms we get as an industry is you're kind of creating a problem where consumers want to come to you and not make payments to the creditors. We view it the other way around. The problem already exists. If you take that someone out, you're still going to have consumers who are struggling with collection calls from their creditors, who are in courthouses because they're being sued over their debts. This is an existing problem. We're a response to the problem. We're not the cause of the problem.
And before I go on, I wanted to give USOBA a chance to answer the questions that I asked Mr. Young. Would your answers be the same?
Yes, as far as that goes, it is. I would like to go back and address the fee issue, if you don't mind,
sure.
That you brought up earlier. We also don't have any particular standardized required fee or fee limitation, but I did want to give you just one short illustration. Let's just assume that you call a contractor, a dentist, an attorney, anything, as a consumer, to hire them for a professional service. Not one single one of those will pick up a pen, a hammer, or a dental instrument without first receiving some type of payment. I think that removing that from the scenario as something that's wrong to do in a profession and focus on the fact that this is a program and it is a commitment and is something that the consumer is hiring us to do for them and be an advocate for them. Creditors don't pay us. Creditors didn't create us. They certainly work with us. I can say that we're not having the same issues that the credit counseling agencies are having by having any of our income or the willingness to work with us lessen. But for instance, I heard it stated earlier that if a consumer ends up after 3 years paying the same amount that they brought into the program, let's say $10,000, we settle it for $5,000 in 3 years, and we take $5,000 as a fee, which is a pretty ridiculously high fee. But just for instance, this person is now stress-free, unsecured debt-free, and the alternative is, what, 20 years of minimum payments and maybe $30,000 at the end?
Right.
So I don't like to hear the argument that the person isn't better off. They're absolutely better off than 20 years of minimum payments. So that's the only thing I wanted to address on the fee.
So, and your answer to the use of trust accounts, your organizations don't work with other corporations or individuals to set up trust accounts?
Historically, no. That if there's one or two companies that maybe are run by law firms or something like that, that have a completely separate set of standards and rules as far as their own fiduciaries and that kind of thing. But as far as the debt settlement company, no. We don't hold clients' money. The same companies he was referencing earlier are a very large standard in the debt settlement industry. That separation for all of us is very important. We certainly don't want any lines crossed, any funds mingled, commingled, or any impropriety at all. The accounts are wholly owned by the consumer, wholly in the control of the consumer, and not something we have access to or can pull from.
Thank you. Ripson Wingard, I think, was next.
Mr. Chair, I have a series of questions I'm hoping to ask to probe on some of these issues we've been talking about.
We'll give you a couple anyway.
Okay. I want to make sure that I heard some things as I've been listening to the testimony on what everybody provides here. What I thought I heard you say was that when a consumer in distress goes to a debt management company, on average the best that they can hope for is about a 16% reduction. I heard somebody give that figure. That part of your niche is that you believe you can ultimately get them a better reduction on their debt than what they can expect from the debt management?
As representative, I was citing a previous witness, Jan Amley, I believe, said this, that what the credit counseling model does is that the consumer still pays back the entire balance of debt. But if they were paying 25% interest at a 25% interest rate, that interest rate, the concession they get is a reduced interest rate. So they still pay back the entire balance of debt, but at a 16% interest rate, is the interest rate she quoted. So what they would do is set up a fixed payment plan over usually 5 years, pay back that debt at a 16% interest rate, and it's like a house payment almost, or a car payment. You just pay the same amount every month until it's paid off.
Okay. Follow-up? So your business model is, whereas that business model is designed, if I come to you with $10,000 of debt and a 25% interest, I'm with a debt management company, I'm looking at eventually paying more than $10,000, but getting a reduction in that interest. Your business model is to try to freeze that amount and ultimately negotiate a settlement on that $10,000, to essentially stop the bleeding, if you will, and then to help the consumer settle the outstanding balance. I mean, have I heard that right?
Very, very close. The one thing is we are not able to freeze the balance. They likely will still incur some interest in charges if they start off at $10,000, but it may go up to $12,000 or $13,000. If we settle that debt at $6,000, that's still a substantial savings. Plus, you know, they would have accrued interest anyways, whether they were in a credit counseling program or whether they tried to pay back the debts in minimum payments.
But your business model is not to get them on a long-term payoff of the debt that they owe at some reduced interest rate. You are looking to negotiate a final settlement over a much shorter period of time. Obviously, what I sense from hearing your business model is they essentially allow the problem to get worse for a short period of time, which triggers some mechanisms at the credit companies to begin negotiating at lower levels in order to write this off. Because when they come to you, they're not necessarily in distress with the credit card companies, but they know they will be shortly. And so you have a program of essentially going to DEFCON 1 in a short period of time in order to trigger some serious negotiations on reducing the debt. Is that what I've heard?
Yeah, the key is to reduce the debt.
Chair, may I respond? Mm. It was an interesting way that you put. So you think you can do better? So if I came to you with my $10,000 instead of going to them with my $10,000, I would be better off. I think that is not the typical view of the way that we look at you as a consumer. First, you come in. Are you appropriate? Can you pay your own bills? If you can pay your own bills, you're not coming into the program. If you can afford to pay back your principal in full plus a little interest or plus some on the side, we're referring you to credit counseling. If you're appropriate for us, you're a truck driver, you just broke both your legs, you're already robbing Peter to pay Paul, may have tapped into your retirement, may have tapped into any savings that you might have had, refinanced your house, done what you can do. These are not, you walk off the street deciding not to pay your bills. And quite frankly, as an organization, and maybe there are companies out there that do this, but we certainly don't advocate for aiding and abetting the fraud of creditors in these memberships. I know that we don't. We don't represent the entire industry, and that's a shame. But the companies that we do represent, it's certainly not a we can do better than them mentality. We have a very specific niche. It's not beneficial for us to take clients on that are not going to be successful in this program. What are they going to do? Call you and complain, I'm not successful in this program. I didn't complete this. I didn't get what I wanted from these people. Do we want them to call you? Absolutely not. We do everything we can to ensure the successful completion, the appropriateness of our consumers for these programs, and again, unfortunately, that may not be the case across the board. But I just wanted to clarify that there are standards out there and there are qualification processes.
Thank you. And I'm probably going to move on with some other testimony. I appreciate your testimony today. I am interested in your standards. I will tell you that I have had a constituent call me with a complaint, and it was dealt with. But it was very disturbing to me to find out the ins and outs of what happened in that particular case. And actually, I've had two cases of it in the last year. So it is very disturbing to me to find out that people are getting hooked up with supposed credit debt settlement companies and are being taken advantage of. And I don't say that lightly, being this public testimony. I'm very careful about what I do say and what I don't. But it occurs to me that when people don't have the ability to repay their debt, that they shouldn't be hooked up and start paying fees and working with people who are setting up trust accounts, and you say you don't do that, and that's a good thing probably. But there's a problem in the industry out there, and I hope that we can figure out what to do about it. So thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson Holvey and committee.
Next up, I'd like to have Keith Carnes and Angela Martin.
Good
excuse me, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Keith Carnes. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm also a member of many national and local consumer protection groups. However, it's as a private attorney who engages in two types of law that affect this type of issue. The first of which is my firm does a significant amount of bankruptcy work. In fact, over the last 5 or 6 months, we've received on average over 200 retainers a month for filing bankruptcy. And I also deal with collection harassment and claims under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. I come to you with grave concern about the debt settlement practices that are being advertised on the television, radio, and internet. The basic model of many of these, if not all of them, is to make the debtor appear insolvent. If Citibank, who is itself having cash problems, believes that a consumer is failing to make payments or heading into bankruptcy, they would certainly be willing to take far less money from that consumer as a lump sum than they would if the consumer were paying on time and had good credit. The problem that we run into is that these debt settlement companies are bombarding folks with promises of settling for 40, 50, 60, or 70% of these debts. But then oftentimes they're not able to perform because by the time a borrower is approaching one of these debt settlement companies and pays them a few thousand dollars, we're finding in Oregon that many of the consumers are then getting sued and garnished before any debts can be settled. I've attached to my testimony some exhibits. In the sake of time, I'd like to just go through those quickly. Exhibit A, now these exhibits from the web are ones that I randomly pulled off today. Well, not randomly. I went to Google and typed in debt settlement, and these were all on the front page of Google in debt settlement. They are claiming to be, in Exhibit A, certified superior debt settlement consultants, certified debt settlement consultants, and certified debt negotiation officers. But no one seems to know or be able to explain who certifies these people and what sort of credentials they have. Turning to Exhibit B, page 2, they ask the question, is it legal? You have the right, says definitely, you have the right to appoint a third party to represent you in debt matters. We are not attorneys and do not give legal advice. However, then they go on to give legal advice about the tax consequences of settling your debts, about lawsuits, about garnishments, and the like. They are acting as attorneys despite the fact that these people appear to have never taken the bar. In fact, the group before us gave some gross legal misstatements. Everyone qualifies for bankruptcy. There is not a single person in the United States, whether they are an illegal alien or Bill Gates, who does not qualify for bankruptcy. It is simply a false statement to say that people don't qualify for bankruptcy. Secondly, the idea that you can't buy a house for 10 years after you file bankruptcy is flatly false and absurd. Consumer credit has always been measured on 2 years. Due to the current financial crisis, they're now measuring it in 4 years. But we have clients who, 4 years after they're discharged their debts in bankruptcy, if they can show that they have steady income, they have down payment, and have been making their payments since their bankruptcy, 4 years afterwards, they're getting good interest rates on their homes. And so the concern is there's so much misinformation out there being spewed out by these debt settlement companies that they're confusing folks into going into them instead of actually going into other alternatives. Perhaps the most grave issue, though, is who will and who won't deal with debt settlement companies. If you look at Exhibit C, Freedom Debt Relief puts right on their advice regarding creditor calls that if MBNA or Citibank calls you, do not tell them that you are dealing with a debt settlement company. And the reason why comes from the next document, which was taken from litigation. Citibank will not settle any accounts that are being handled by debt management companies, monetary protesters, and the like. Specifically, these types of folks who are just here saying that, you know, they provide a service, Citibank refuses to settle with those companies. And so even if they have the best intentions and the best ideas in the world, if Citibank won't do it and MBNA won't do it, and in the Wall Street Journal article I attached as Exhibit F, American Express says they won't settle with these people either. And so the question is, who are they settling with? You know, what kind of services can they really provide if three of the largest lenders in the country refuse to do any settlement with these folks whatsoever? I do owe these debt settlement companies a small debt of gratitude, though, because we have a lot of folks who come to us and file bankruptcy because they are now getting garnished and they're now being hounded by debt collectors. And so, to that extent, I'm thankful that they exist. However, it's far better for Oregon as a whole that they be put out of business, that there just be flat prohibitions on this type of work because they're deceptive and because they really can't do anything that they say they're going to do in a large scale. There's far more folks who are paying money that they just can't afford to pay, and that's all being taken as profit rather than debt settlement that's actually going on. I wish I could have brought some clients in. Unfortunately, there aren't many people who are willing to come in and say to the state of Oregon, you know, I'm out of money and I filed bankruptcy because of what's happened to me. But I assure you, all of our attorneys have literally dozens of people a month come to them and say, we went through these debt settlement companies and now we're far worse off than what we ever started. And if we can just put prohibitions on them, I think we'll be far better off. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you so much for taking up this issue. Angela Martin with Our Oregon. As you may know, Our Oregon is a statewide nonprofit working on tax and economic fairness. And more, the concept of economic fairness brings me right into the issue of credit and debt issues. That's where folks are flailing and hurting. Just this morning, I sent out an alert to 15,000 individuals on our email alert list on a related debt collection piece of legislation. Within 5 minutes, I received a response from a woman who talked to me about the endless phone calls that she received from debt collectors on a debt that her husband, who has now passed away, on a debt he accrued while dealing with renal failure. After he died, after she is going through the grieving process, she is now bombarded with messages from people who are going to help her deal with this debt. She was simply at her wit's end, and I think this is exemplifies the people who are so desperate that they turn to folks who have appropriately identified the problem. Individuals are drowning in debt and need help, but they have developed a business model that is inappropriate to solve that problem. And that inappropriate business model is one in which consumers, as we've heard it spelled out today with debt settlement, consumers are advised to stop making payments. Consumers are still liable for the interest and penalties that accrue on those. They're still liable for debt collection practices that subject their wages to garnishment and the like. As we move forward, as you move forward, to debate a solution to this problem, I would urge a few things to be taken into consideration. If this body chooses to move forward with 2191 as the model, I would certainly advocate for a strong limitation on fees, both upfront and a limitation on the ultimate cap that is allowed as a percentage of the payment to the creditor. Fine to allow for a percentage of the payment to be returned to the organization as a fee, but there should be an ultimate cap to that amount. We must curb the aggressive and deceptive advertising filled with false promises that are illegal. We must prohibit certain practices such as collecting monies from consumer into an account while withholding payments to their creditors. This does not set a consumer up to succeed. And more than anything, as we get the consumer protections into an appropriate law, we must have appropriate enforcement. I would offer that enforcement has to come in three components. We have to have an agency enforcement so that our Department of Consumer and Business Services are serving as effective regulators and licensors of debt management companies. We need the reach of the Department of Justice through the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and individuals should be allowed to protect themselves through a private right of action. Proper enforcement coupled with smart consumer protections will set more Oregon consumers up to succeed and reach the day that we all want to reach, and that's when we all have a zero balance on our credits due. Again, thank you for the time you're taking on this issue.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Don't see any questions from the committee. I have one for you, Mr. Carnes, being that you're an attorney that works in related topics, I guess. As an attorney, do consumers come to attorneys and have them set up trust accounts to pay off their debt or settle their debt as such?
In my experience, Chair Holvey, is that they don't do that. That's nothing that our firm offers, simply because we don't have the time or the manpower to do such a thing. You know, we're kind of stretched thin given the, you know, all the other problems that we're trying to help fix. When we have folks who qualify for that type of thing, we refer them to consumer credit counseling. We refer them to a local nonprofit that can do something for them. Or I tell them, you know, there's nothing magical about it. I mean, if you can come up with cash on the barrelhead, then just give it to them. Just say, hey, I'll give you 50% of what I owe you in exchange for a release, and make sure it's all done in writing. And I give that advice out for free to anybody who asks. Anybody who says, what are my alternatives to bankruptcy? And folks who don't have that much debt, that's what I tell them. Just call them up and say, this is what I can pay you. And don't promise them a stream of income, but give them a lump sum when you, with your tax refund or a large check or a loan from a relative, and settle the debts up yourself. And we think that's a far better practice, and it saves them money. I mean, I don't want to be billing people, you know, attorney rates to do something that they can do for themselves.
So I guess my question goes to the business model, I suppose, of a company soliciting people who are in credit trouble and having a trust account set up through a separate attorney and funneling direct deposits out of the consumer's account into that trust account. Do you see that as a viable model to pay off someone's debt?
Well, it would get the job done, and I have seen it. I'm sorry. I have seen it done, but not by any local Oregon attorneys. I've seen it done through California firms that are tied into these big national outfits that are trying to do it on a large scale. I don't know any of attorneys that you could go shake their hand and say, can you settle up my debts for me? I have seen out of California, out of the Santa Barbara area, if I remember right, where this law firm got involved to try and settle up these debts. And it would work. I mean, if you can give a creditor a lump sum of money to settle up a debt when that person's, you know, 90 or 120 or days delinquent or more, absolutely, you can settle up those debts. There's no question about whether it works or not. The question is, you know, how much money can you make off these people's backs for something that they could and should be doing for themselves?
Thank you.
I hope that answers your question.
Almost, not quite.
Oh, sorry.
I'll try again some other day. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you.
I just, Mr. Chair, would like to make the statement that I've hired a few attorneys in my life, and I've never known it to be an inexpensive experience.
Well, I appreciate you testifying today. I don't see anyone else signed up to testify. We do have some written testimony to deliver to the committee to put on the record. And again, if you wish to be informed about our work group and the language that we will consider going forward, please give your name to our committee administrator, Victoria Cox, here. And I hope that we'll get a work group going, and I don't know if there's any specific legislators here that may be interested in helping out with that work group or not. I'm probably going to try to when my time allows, but I know we'll have participation from the DCBS, I'm hoping. I see they're nodding their heads, so we'll have some agency involved, and I know a few others have said they'd be willing to help us out to address this issue.
Mr. Chair?
I'm just curious, is it your hope then that the work group will sort of come up with a combination of these two bills that we were hearing today?
Not necessarily, but, you know, perhaps.
Or an alternate that...
Or an alternative,
basically,
yeah.
You're not planning to move one forward as opposed to the other until a work group has a chance to meet.
Yeah, I'm going to be looking for the work group to have some input into the issue and see what model. There's two different models, I guess. One of them just prohibits debt settlement
right.
companies from a for-profit business model. And the other one is licensure and regulation by the department, albeit that's, you know, a good way to regulate the industry. It doesn't necessarily, in and of itself, provide protections to consumers. So we want to try to figure out how we can accomplish that protection at the same time. So, and I, quite frankly, don't know what it's going to look like exactly at this point. I'm keeping an open mind, I hope, and as much as I can in this field, and we'll see what we come up with, and hopefully it won't be a couple weeks out, maybe 3 weeks, we'll have another product to come forward to the committee with. So any other comments down there? I thought you were trying to get in a comment there.
Certainly not, sir.
Oh, okay.
Not at this hour.
Not that accurate.
Hey.
With that, I appreciate everybody's attention to this, and with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2191 and House Bill 2368, and I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
I need one like that.